You heard Sonari mention Chrysler's new slogan, imported from Detroit. Slogans are our last word in business today because a slogan can do a lot for a company or for a city for that matter.
Just think of what the I Love New York slogan did for the Big Apple. This year, several cities announced new slogans to try and enhance their images. Buffalo came up with Buffalo for Real.
Chicago is branding itself second to none.
Colorado Springs decided on Live It Up.
And now, in a few days, Morrow, Georgia will roll out its new city motto. Come tomorrow, today.
I liked it immediately. I like the simplicity of it.
Mike Sakowitz Toomey is president of the Morrow Business and Tourism Association.
Now, is it very original? You know, since I grew up here, I've heard this for years. You know, why don't you come tomorrow, you know? Or they said, no, I want to come today. It's kind of like that, you know, who's on first play on word. So it was not necessarily new to me, but sometimes something like that, you know, you don't look any further than your own backyard, and it was there all the time. You know, I'm sounding like Patti LaBelle now, you know. You were there all the time.
Or it's like Dorothy in The Wizard of Oz. Everything I wanted turned out to be at home. That's the business news on Morning Edition from NPR News. We hope you'll tune in tomorrow. I'm Steve Inskeep.
And I'm Linda Wertheimer. It's been a good year overall for the auto industry, despite a sluggish economy. And among the big three in Detroit, there's a clear standout. From marketing and advertising to car quality and even sales, this year's winner is Chrysler. From Detroit, NPR's Sonari Glinton reports.
2011 for Chrysler began at the Detroit Auto Show last January. That's when Chrysler's president, Olivier Francois, who's French, took the stage to reintroduce a struggling company to the world.
I remember leaving a booth with no new products, finding my 300 in the basement and driving out into the cold, down Woodward Avenue on my way to my new home, and even lost a little.
If I can sum up the feeling of the automotive press at the time, it wasn't just, is Chrysler going to be okay, but is this guy going to make it through this?
Look, if you have one shot or one opportunity to seize everything you ever wanted in one moment, would you capture it or just let it slip? Yo.
That yo sounds kind of funny coming in a French accent. Francois was brought in to run Chrysler by its new European owner, Fiat. Francois was quoting Detroit rapper Eminem and his Oscar-winning song, Lose Yourself. The song had already been kind of an anthem for Detroit and became one for Chrysler. This wasn't Chrysler's once in a lifetime. It's been more like its third or fourth. Chrysler was planning to increase sales and introduce new products, and it did just that.
What they've been able to achieve on not very much money and with not a tremendous amount of new product has been pretty phenomenal.
Michelle Krebs is an analyst with Edmunds.com. She's been covering the car business since before the first government bailout of Chrysler in the 80s.
Because they didn't have a lot of the same advantage that General Motors did coming out of bankruptcy. They didn't have all their debt wiped off. They didn't have product in the pipeline because they'd been pretty much starved of product by under previous regimes.
So without the advantages of other companies, Chrysler had to rebrand itself for the American consumer, and Chrysler did it with one commercial during the Super Bowl.
Because when it comes to luxury, it's as much about where it's from as who it's for. Now, we're from America, but this isn't New York City or the Windy City or Sin City, and we're certainly no one's Emerald City.
Chrysler's imported from Detroit theme helped change some of the attitudes about Chrysler and a few about Detroit. Sales followed. Sales have gone up 25% so far this year. That's about twice the industry average. And not only are they selling more cars, but according to Consumer Reports' David Champion, the company is selling better cars.
In terms of Chrysler, they've actually improved the Chrysler brand no end. The Jeep Grand Cherokee, the Dodge Durango, and the Chrysler 200 all did well in our reliability survey, even in their first year.
Italy's Fiat came to the rescue of Chrysler, and despite some bumps, the Italian carmaker has helped Chrysler to focus on products and financial stability. Chrysler repaid nearly $8 billion in bailout loans it got from the Canadian and U.S. governments after it filed for bankruptcy in 2009, and it began to turn a profit. 2011 will likely be the first fully profitable year for Chrysler since 2005. The analyst Michelle Krebs says now with the European debt crisis, Fiat and Chrysler are reversing roles.
Chrysler's right now supporting Fiat because Fiat in Italy is floundering because the entire European market is softening and is expected to continue to struggle next year because of all of the debt crisis going on, and Italy's right in the middle of it.
Krebs says the danger for Chrysler is the danger for all car companies, a slowing economy. But Michelle Krebs and most other car analysts say Chrysler got its one shot and took it. The company is far from winning the fight, but for now, it's off the ropes. Sonari Glinton, NPR News, Detroit.
We'd like to turn our attention now to Kwanzaa, a week-long celebration between Christmas and New Year's Day that celebrates the heritage and culture of African Americans. It is often celebrated with singing and dancing or storytelling or poetry. Every day also highlights a principle key to building and strengthening family and the larger community. Those principles include unity, purpose, responsibility, and faith. And as you might hope and expect, there is food. But what do you cook for Kwanzaa? That's where our next guest comes in. Sonura Weathers is the founder of the blog Kwanzaa Culinarians. She's gathered a group of food bloggers to share their favorite recipes from the African diaspora during the week of Kwanzaa. She publishes recipes to complement each day's Kwanzaa principle. And Sonura Weathers joins us now from our bureau in New York. Welcome. Happy Kwanzaa. I think Habari Gani is the right greeting, right?
Yes. Thank you for having me.
So what gave you the idea for Kwanzaa Culinarians?
I think the idea originally started with a popular food show host who had a video that went viral when she did a infamous Kwanzaa cake. And as a food person, the fact that it was made with processed ingredients, I'm laughing, but it was insulting at the same time.
And well, she meant well.
Yes, she did. I'm sure she meant well. But I said, you know what? We're a group. There's so many food bloggers out here. We should really get together and present a few recipes that could represent Kwanzaa, coming from our own personal lives and stories and what the African diaspora is really about.
And it doesn't include red dye number two.
Yes.
just to name one ingredient. So you know, Kwanzaa is a relatively new holiday. I mean, I think that's fair to say. I mean, in comparison to, you know, Hanukkah or Christmas or and every culture around the world celebrates New Year's in some way. So is there a traditional Kwanzaa cuisine that you would point to, or Kwanzaa dish?
You know what? I think it depends on where you're coming from. I don't believe there is one traditional cuisine or dish, because the African diaspora is so diverse. And when you look at the food bloggers who are involved, we have people from the Caribbean, the South, Northeast, the West Coast. And hopefully next year we'll have international food bloggers who can contribute their dishes. So I can personally, because my roots are in the South, I would say red beans and rice or sweet potatoes, greens, black-eyed peas, traditional Southern type of dishes. But for somebody like Trini Gourmet, she did this beautiful dish with okra and rice and tomatoes. And then you have people who are vegans, such as Brian Terry. He submitted a recipe it's almost like a candy jams, but it had all these interesting ingredients. I think tamari in it and miso, I think, was in it also.
So it's as varied, really, as the African diaspora, you know, itself. Well, it also sounds to me that this project, and just from reading the blog, got much bigger than you had anticipated. I mean, you are not a Kwanzaa expert. You're a foodie, a self-described foodie. But it sounds to me that you got a far greater response than you expected. Why do you think that is?
I reached out to people And they responded like, yes, I love this idea, or I don't know much about Kwanzaa, but I really want to learn. And this is my first time in which I took it upon myself to learn about the principles and about what it really means.
So just moving along, Thursday is the fourth day of Kwanzaa. Today's mm-hmm. principle is Ujamaa, or cooperative economics. Mm-hmm. Tell us about the meals promoted on the blog for today. I'm thinking stew would be the right idea. Because everybody, like stone soup, everybody could bring something for the stew.
You know what?
That's just my idea.
That's a very good idea.
So I'm going to put you on the spot. What's been your favorite Kwanzaa recipe so far?
Oh, wow. I think Brian Terry's roast, I'm still impressed with that. I love Lisa of Annalise First Amendment. She did these scones, I believe, made out of a fig and pecan and had this caramel or brown butter, some type of icing on top of it. It looks so delicious.
Now where's ours? Where's the kind of spirit of sharing? Where's our sample of the beautiful scones? Sonora,
I'm going to get on her about that. Okay. I will let her know that that is her next assignment.
Okay. Well, happy Kwanzaa. Thank you for joining us.
Thank you very much for having me.
Sonora Weathers is the founder of the blog Kwanzaa Culinarians, and she joined us from our bureau in New York. Thank you so much.
Thank you.
No mountain captures the popular imagination like Everest, the world's tallest peak, remote, towering out of the Himalayan range. It has frequently proven deadly to those who've tried to reach its summit. The most famous of its victims was the first Englishman, George Mallory. In the early 20s, Mallory took part in the first three expeditions up Everest, dying on his third attempt at the peak. Author Wade Davis's new book, Into the Silence, chronicles those expeditions, but this is not just a book about a mountain. It's a book about a generation, about men who survived the horrors of the First World War. Wade Davis joins us. Welcome.
Thanks for having me.
Lots has been written about Mallory. He was the leader of the expedition, but there were other people on this expedition that you sort of single out, or you at various points in the course of this book, and one of them was your fellow Canadian, Oliver Wheeler.
Oliver Wheeler. Well, in pursuing the research on Wheeler, I found out that his son was still alive and living in Vancouver, and I went to see him. And in the course of a wonderful afternoon, he pulled off his shelf two volumes of journals that his father had kept in 1921 as he marched across Everest with Mallory. And no one had ever seen these journals.
You say that he is the unsung hero of the expedition. Why? I mean, what
because
was it
he
that
was the
did?
One who found the route to the mountain. It was not George Mallory, as all the historians have claimed. The route to the mountain, you know, these were ridge walkers. They had to get high, and they had to find a way to the summit of the North Col. That was going to be their route to the mountain.
Explain that word, col.
Col means saddle. It just means saddle. These were ridge walkers. They couldn't go up the face of Everest, so they had spotted from the Rongbuk Glacier a col, a saddle, and if they could get to the top of that, they could then get up the northeast shoulder to the northeast ridge, and they thought that that was the route that could get them to the summit. The challenge was, how could they get to the far side of that col, because from the Rongbuk side, it was unclimbable. And so the key in 1921 was finding the route to the col of their desires, and it was Oliver Wheeler who did that. And that, incidentally, is the route that all climbers take to this day who approach the mountain from the Tibet side.
And he found it how?
Because he was a surveyor, and his job was to map the inner core of Everest, and he did so with incredible courage. He spent more time alone on the mountain, exposed to the wrath of the mountain, than anyone else in 1921. And in doing so, he explored all chinks in its armor, as he put it, and he found the route up the East Rongbuk Glacier. And the challenge was the mouth of the East Rongbuk Glacier was so narrow that Mallory slipped by it three times, thinking it was not worthy of exploration. Wheeler thought everything was worthy of exploration.
Because he was a surveyor, I guess.
He was a map maker.
Now, Howard Bury, who was also a member of the expedition, he has written that Wheeler deserves the greatest credit of all of us. So, I mean, if his contemporaries felt that way about him, why has he been so overshadowed by George Mallory?
Well, George Mallory was on all three expeditions. He was extraordinarily charismatic. He was good-looking. And, of course, he died.
So that
that was a legendary moment in mountaineering history. It was when George Mallory, famously seen going strong for the summit, when the mist rolled in and enveloped his memory in myth.
The other character in this book that is very striking as you read is the First World War. And most of the men who were on this expedition were in that war, and somehow they turned from all that horror to the mountain.
They took their experiences that were never spoken about, yet never forgotten, to the flanks of the mountain. And that's why I was so interested in what was the spirit of the men as they climbed the mountain. My thought always was that death had no mystery for them because they had seen so much of it. And what mattered was how one lived.
Now, you write about that on page 233. There's a section kind of in the middle of the page that I'd like you to read for us.
But for these men, the war had changed the very gestalt of death. In the trenches, they lived it every moment, some like Wheeler, for years. By the time he was 28, he had witnessed the death of hundreds, encountered the shattered bodies of many thousands. Death's power lies in fear, which flourishes in the imagination and the unknown. For Wheeler, there was nothing more that death could show him, short of his own.
And you think that was it? You think they just lost all connection to fear at that point?
I think they were prepared to accept a level of risk that would have been unimaginable before the war.
The other thing that I thought was remarkable about your book was that you describe people who are on this expedition who were grievously wounded in the First World War and were not well when they went up the mountain, and they went anyway.
Oh, absolutely. Jack Hazard climbed to the top of the North Col in 1924 with open bleeding wounds from the Somme beneath his tunic of his climbing gear.
And he just bled all the way up the mountain.
Mm-hmm.
But he got down the mountain also.
The wounds opened up as he was going up the mountain.
And you also describe a man whose legs were virtually shot off at Gallipoli, and they glued him back together.
Well,
and
nothing could hurt General Bruce. I mean, this is a man whose favorite party trick was to rip a pack of cards in half. He used to put his adjutant on his back and for casual exercise run up and down the Khyber Pass. Mm-hmm. And his legs are virtually severed from his body. And he was 18 months in convalescing with strict orders never to ever attempt to climb stairs or to climb uphill. So instead, he just decided to go to Everest.
Extraordinary. I mean, what kind of men are they?
I mean,
how about, you know,
like one of my favorite is Sandy Wollaston, who on 24-hour notice, the London Times responded to an advertisement for a naturalist. He goes off to Uganda, 3 months to catch up to the expedition, 9 months in the jungle, and when he decides he wants to go home, why go back the same way? He walks from the source of the Congo to the mouth. I mean, Howard Bury once anointed his body with scented oils and just naked walked down the Ganges and was famous for having killed a man-eating tiger that had run off and eaten 21 holy men, you know. These were just incredible men, you know, the grit, the strength of character, you know. And these were men who just didn't know that there were limits to what a man could do.
Wade Davis is a National Geographic explorer in residence. He's the author of many books, but this latest one is Into the Silence, The Great War, Mallory, and the Conquest of Everest. Thank you very much for coming in.
Thank you for having me.
And let's talk next about the largest freestanding mountain on the planet. Kilimanjaro is a dormant volcano, not part of a mountain range like Everest, and it soars more than 19,000 feet. A pitcher from the New York Mets is planning to climb it. R.A. Dickey is leading a trip to the top to raise money and awareness for a group that assists victims of sex trafficking in India. Now, Kilimanjaro in Africa is not considered the hardest climb in the world, but Mets management is not too excited that Mr. Dickey is going. The team can't prevent him from climbing, but they've sent the pitcher a letter reminding him that if he gets injured, the Mets could void the rest of his multi-million dollar contract. Dickey tells the Wall Street Journal he's not concerned. Quote, "It's not like it's Everest." This is NPR News. Americans' sense of insecurity came in part from the stock market, which rose and fell in breathtaking ways this year, especially over the summer. It was normal for a while for the market to drop by hundreds of points, only to rise by hundreds the next day. As we near the end of this year, though, the market is up modestly from the start of the year, around 500 points. And it turns out that even with the nauseating turns in this market, many technology firms raised a lot of money when they went public. NPR's Aarti Shahani reports.
About the same number of technology companies went public this year as last year. Difference is, they managed to raise over $6 billion, a whopping 85% increase over 2010. Compared to all other industries, tech companies saw the highest returns in the first week of trading. 2011 was the year of mega brands. The biggest name in the mix, Groupon.
Groupon opens its first day of trading on the NASDAQ this morning.
It raised half as much as Google did when it went public. A splashy debut for sure. Turns out, though, it may be a washout.
If you want, buy the coupon, don't buy the stock. Buy the coupon, not the Groupon.
That's Sam Hamada. He's the CEO of Privco. He analyzes the financial data of companies across sectors. He says tech is a great investment because it makes valuable products with low labor costs. But for Groupon, that's not the case.
Once people looked under the hood, they realized really Groupon has no proprietary technology of any significance.
So if it's not tech, what is it?
Groupon effectively is a local advertising and couponing company. What that requires is a lot of local salespeople. It's a very labor-intensive business.
Groupon stock is worth less today than its closing price on day one. Not a great sign. Though not as bleak as Zynga. Zynga is the maker of Farmville, the popular game on the social network Facebook. The company mints real dollars by selling imaginary goods, like tractors that plow cornfields that only exist on a computer screen. For the vast majority of companies that go public, stock on day one closes higher than the initial offering price. Not Zynga, even though it priced its stock low. Investors lost real dollars. It's the textbook definition of a busted IPO.
It's embarrassing to the investment banks that took them public. A failure by almost any measure.
Though not when you measure how much Zynga raised. Peter Coles is a professor at Harvard Business School. But you don't have to teach there to know.
$1 billion is a fantastic amount of money to raise for Zynga.
For anyone, in fact. Zynga's IPO is the biggest tech IPO since Google's in 2004. The biggest success story this year was LinkedIn, the online Rolodex. It had a first-day pop. Investors paid well above the asking price, and the stock today is worth 40% more than when it debuted. On the surface, it makes no sense. The millions of people on LinkedIn don't even pay a dime. Why would investors pay? Coles explains the business model.
LinkedIn has become the number one tool for passive job search. That's where you are. That's where your contacts are. It's not worth our time to join another LinkedIn Rolodex-like substitute, and recruiters are willing to pay a lot of money for access to this fantastic user base.
The company, it's like a party host. One side comes in for free. The other side, in this case the headhunter, pays to enter. It's a strong network, an industry best practice. Losing your user base? That's a worst nightmare. Zillow is among the smallest companies to go public this year. Zillow lets people look up real estate prices in real time, even through cell phones. CEO Spencer Raskoff says that short of a strong network, you've got to inspire loyalty.
It's all that more important in technology for products and services to tug at an emotional heartstring. Another website is just a click away. Another mobile app is just a click away.
The most anticipated tech IPO in 2012? Facebook.
The beauty of Facebook is that it is impossible to leave.
Facebook is the best of the 2011 companies on steroids. Tech savvy, strong network, loyal users. Some say it's worth $100 billion. We'll know for sure when it flexes for public investors. Aarti Shahani, NPR News.
You're listening to Morning Edition from NPR News.